All participants, please stand by. Your conference is ready to begin. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Access Privacy Monthly conference call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Adam Kardash. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and hello, everyone, and welcome to our October monthly privacy call. For colleagues who are not able to join us today, note that our Access Privacy calls are all incorporated under the Resources tab of our online platform for subscribers to listen to anytime at their convenience. And while we don't have an opportunity to answer questions during our calls, subscribers can find more information on today's topics and many others in this month's monthly scan, also available under the Resources tab of our new subscription platform. The scan is intended to provide subscribers with a convenient one-page snapshot to a consolidated list of hyperlinks to recent decisions, guidance documents, and other notable developments that have occurred in the privacy arena over the past month, together with easily accessible links all in one place to help keep you in the know and hopefully save you valuable time. You'll note from yesterday's monthly call reminder that we have just significantly enhanced our subscription-based platform, and now in addition to our private sector and health and public sector resources, we have just launched yesterday our health sector portal. It's in beta phase now, but already contains a wealth of resources on the health privacy legislative landscape across the country, including a snapshot overview, topic summaries, and very helpful and easily accessible charts and legislative requirements from provincial health privacy legislation, including on topics such as provincial requirements for companies acting as service providers, agents, and information managers, a breach notification topic hub with a great snapshot summary chart of the various requirements across the country, the new consumer electronic service provider provisions on Ontario's PHIPAA, which I've spoken about earlier this year on a monthly call, and be very impactful on a number of private sector entities who are acting in the public in the privacy and wealth and wellness space, a summary of enforcement and administrative penalty provisions across the country, topic upshots on the requirement for health cards and health numbers, and so much more, including snooping and other very, very helpful topics. We use these information resources multiple times daily for our practice. They become invaluable to us as they just save a ton of time. In essence, the private, public, and now health sector portals are a key facet of our internal knowledge management, and I invite you to take advantage of the resource offering. We'll be regularly adding content to the hubs, including at least one new major topic a month for our now beta health sectoral hub. And now for return to today's call, and we are very privileged to be joined by Patricia Cosame, the Information and Privacy Commissioner of Ontario. Commissioner Cosame, thank you for joining us and welcome.
Thank you, Adam. It's great to be here.
You've been commissioner now for almost 4 months. Can you share with us a reflection on your experiences thus far?
Well, certainly. First of all, I have to say it's been great, and I've inherited such a wonderful team that's really facilitated my arrival. Such a strong, vibrant, and highly collegial professional office with deep subject matter expertise and great passion for the work. And as I often say to many people who ask me how I'm doing, I tell them I'm the luckiest commissioner in the world. Of course, you know, my whole mandate has been defined so far by COVID-19. And as an example, my very first challenge, which literally started on my first day on the job, was dealing with the COVID alert app. Now, talk about trial by fire. Very early on, I learned to collaborate with my federal counterpart from the other side. I learned how to effectively persuade the Ontario government to further enhance the privacy protections of the app, which to their credit, they did. I had to learn how to communicate publicly about a complex and highly mediatized subject in my new role, wearing the moniker of commissioner. And most importantly, I had to learn to get comfortable with risk, the risk of endorsing an app, knowing how important it was to encourage widespread adoption for the benefit of society, yet also knowing the risks of something going off the rails, however unlikely, far and remote that might be. So the COVID has certainly been a key part of the experience. I'd say my first 100 days were deliberately dedicated to learning about the office by meeting staff. I asked for a series of 101s on many different topics, and I spent a lot of time getting to know external stakeholders, particularly in the provincial sphere. And the fact that I wasn't able to do so in person, I'd say, was very difficult for me, as I tend to be very much a people person, and I enjoy the face-to-face personal contact. But what's been interesting, I don't know if you found this, but I found how much more I've come to notice other things. It's like that, you know, that well-documented phenomenon, Adam, when one of your senses is down, how much more acute your other senses become. So without the face-to-face contact, I've had to learn to recognize people's voices, even though I can't see them. And I've become much more attentive to what they're saying. And certainly being in listening mode when you're starting out in a new role and learning the ropes is actually a very good thing. So that, in a nutshell, has been my first 4 months.
Let's turn now to legislative reform. In an op-ed piece, a blog post, and most recently in a very thoughtful submission that your office submitted to the Ontario government, who have launched a consultation for a private sector privacy law in the province, you've indicated that the time has now come for a Made in Ontario private sector privacy law. So, in essence, why does Ontario need a private sector privacy law?
Well, that's a very interesting question and a very timely one, in fact. Just generally speaking, it always struck me how Ontario, being the most densely populated province in Canada, never adopted its own substantially similar law like BC, Alberta, and Quebec did, for instance. But be that as it may, one of the reasons why I think the time has come for Ontario to do so is just how ill-served Ontarians have become with PIPEDA. And I say this from all sides, businesses as well as consumers, particularly as PIPEDA has fallen behind the times. And it seems to me Ontario can do a lot better, particularly given its track record of introducing significant statutory innovations that have really become a model for others to follow. And I'm thinking here of concepts such as prescribed entities, data integration units, interoperability standards, all of these that I've always looked to Ontario for as being really innovative legal concepts to try to deal with really complex issues. But even if PIPEDA were to be amended and significantly improved, which I think it's time to do, there would still be important, I think, to consider Made in Ontario private sector privacy law to cover important gaps that PIPEDA, even in the best form, could never fill, constitutionally speaking. So, for example, it's flabbergasting to think that employees of provincially regulated companies in Ontario are without any statutory privacy protection and would remain unprotected even if PIPEDA were reformed. Again, because of constitutional limits, PIPEDA couldn't cover not-for-profit organizations like charities, professional associations, and unions, for example. And it would be an opportunity for Ontario to cover these organizations that, face it, collect and hold and maintain significant volumes of Ontarians' personal information. And much has been said and written, of course, particularly in the recent couple of years, about the importance of covering political parties, which PIPEDA, of course, couldn't do with respect to the provincial political parties, but an Ontario law could. Made in Ontario private sector privacy law would also be able to cover things like the age of consent, substitute decision making, and privacy protection in the context of litigation, for example, which we know from the State Farm decision is pretty much hands-off for the federal government. Also, I would say that it would be an important opportunity to better integrate laws and regulations in Ontario, particularly for Ontario-specific projects and initiatives that lie at the intersection of public, private, and health sectors. So right now, for instance, trying to integrate Ontario's FIPPA, MFIPPA, and PHIPPA on the one hand with the federal PIPEDA is a bit like trying to match ill-fitting pieces of different puzzles and having to deal with different regulators. Whereas made in Ontario private sector privacy law that's designed to be part of a comprehensive, better integrated regulatory regime overall, where the laws are crafted to fit together under a single regulator, it seems to me would be much more conducive to spurring innovation in the province and certainly supporting public-private collaborations and partnerships. I think Ontario has an opportunity, particularly now, to learn from many global experiments playing out around the world, not least of which is the GDPR, choosing the best parts that are proving to be working well while avoiding those that are not working out so well. And Ontario can adapt its law in a manner that's right for Ontarians and suits our local values and culture, all the while still allowing for harmonization and certainly interoperability with other jurisdictions around the world and of course, across Canada.
What you've just alluded to a theme and the IPC's submission to the Ontario government as part of its consultation for a private sector law, your IPC submission expressly refers to concepts of a regulatory morass, duplicative investigative processes, and potentially conflicting outcomes. These are also themes that I spoke about as the core focus of last monthly call in connection with the current data regulatory landscape across Canada. And if we just take by way of example an enterprise who unfortunately becomes a victim of a security incident impacting individuals across the country, they're faced with notification requirements. It could be federally in Alberta, and if it's the health sector, in multiple health privacy statutes across the country, there's separate notifications with each regulatory authority, separate interactions now, queries from each, and possibly one or more investigations with different regulatory authorities. And you could just get, with that simple example, you could see those themes being manifested just with that one use case. In essence, private sector companies are becoming increasingly concerned about the looming burden of the data regulatory environment, and the current consultation efforts and legislative reform efforts, Quebec, Ontario that we're talking about, in BC and federally, it's just exacerbating these concerns. So simply put, how do we ensure that a new Ontario private sector privacy law doesn't further exacerbate these very legitimate concerns?
I think that's a really important question and certainly raises legitimate concerns. And I mean, to be frank, the issue of harmonization is a perennial issue for a country like Canada because of its provincial, federal, territorial constitution. But it's also a global issue for multinational organizations. And certainly, I think a well-thought-out law can be designed to be harmonized and interoperable with those of other jurisdictions without necessarily being the same. And to take the example you just gave about a breach situation, if drafters were to sit down with pen and paper to draft an Ontario private sector privacy law, I, for one, would certainly encourage them to look at those laws that have already a breach notification regime in the private sector, like Alberta and federally, for instance, and to emulate breach notification standards and thresholds that are already proving to work well and with which we've gained a lot of practical experience and have become ingrained in the psyche of many businesses across the country. So why not, for instance, adopt the real risk of significant harm standard and a similar time requirement for breach notification in Ontario? In fact, from a practical perspective, and you would know this, Adam, dealing with many, many of the biggest breaches, it wouldn't make sense to deviate from those already established thresholds or standards. You can imagine, for example, if Ontario were to adopt a more or less stringent standard, that would mean that some Canadians would learn about the breach before others, which, you know, for all intents and purposes, particularly as media got whiff of it, means that all Canadians would learn about it as the word got around. So adopting a different threshold for the sake of being different would really make no practical sense, and in fact would be self-defeating in that particular circumstance. So harmonization, where there's an opportunity to harmonize and no real substantial reason for deviation, is key, I think, to a successful and interoperable private sector privacy regime. On the other hand, if drafters of an Ontario law were to give thoughtful consideration to the kinds of principles that would underpin an Ontario-specific private sector privacy law, I think there would be an opportunity to think about which principles, you know, accord best with Ontarians' culture and values. And if that means introducing new principles such as fairness and equity, for example, that may be a good thing, not only for Ontarians, but for future legislative drafters who may wish to emulate Ontario's example. You know, a while ago, several years ago, I wrote an article on this subject, recognizing how privacy laws in Canada have evolved incrementally over the years, with each generation of new laws, in a sense, introducing new ideas and innovations that have charted new paths for others to follow in subsequent reforms. I'm thinking here not only of private sector, but health sector laws, for instance, are a good example how every generation of health sector laws sort of built on the previous ones and further improved on them. And the idea of pure sameness would actually kill the opportunity to improve statutes over time. So in my view, I think the key is in not being afraid to innovate and show the way for others, all the while harmonizing standards and thresholds where it makes most sense to do so.
To foster trust in the emerging data ecosystem, it's important to have a regime that gives the public confidence that there are appropriate repercussions for bad behavior. And the IPC's submission to the Ontario government thoughtfully lays out a prospective enforcement regime, including, in my view, and critically, and something we've spoken about on past monthly calls, an express reference to the necessity for procedural fairness. But the submission also speaks about an enforcement regime that rewards good behavior, which is very refreshing. Because so much of the focus is on the so-called bad actors. The IPC submission talks about incentivizing good behavior. So conceptually, rewarding good behavior would be a superb way to foster and enhance trust. How do we do this?
I think that's a great question. And just by the way, as a lawyer who's worked on all sides of the fence, I do wholeheartedly believe in the importance of procedural fairness in enforcement, which I think is key to a fair and well-balanced regime and certainly a credible and effective regulator. But apart from, as you say, taking enforcement against bad actors, I'm really taken with the view or the perspective of an effective regulator that needs to support and incentivize good actors as well. And a lot of good work has been done in this area by CIPL, who wrote a very thoughtful paper on an effective enforcement regime that supports all ends of the spectrum. And I'm very thankful to them for putting out that thoughtful paper. I think certainly one thing I've really come to appreciate is that regulators don't hold all truths. There are incredibly smart, dedicated, and strong privacy champions in Canada, members of the Privacy Access Bar, chief privacy officers par excellence. We have civil society and very strong academics specialized in this field. So one of the most important things a regulator can do, in my view, is create and nurture a forum or fora for cross-sectoral discourse to encourage and support innovative ideas and solutions to come forward. And there are increasing and really interesting ways to do this. So for instance, I've always been a great believer in research. The contribution program created under PIPEDA is one of the, in my view, the crown jewels of the federal regime. And I would hope that Ontario, if it were to create a private sector privacy law, would follow that model. And there are other countries that have followed PIPEDA in this regard. I'm thinking of the WITH research program. I'm thinking namely of the ICO in the UK, among others. There's a fundamentally important role, I think, for a regulator to play in promoting research in key strategic areas to help advance knowledge on certainly relevant and timely issues, but then an equally important and critical role to encourage the dissemination and application of that new knowledge in the broader community. So research is certainly, and research and knowledge dissemination is certainly one of the ways a regulator can support the responsible actors interested in finding responsible solutions. I think also affording a genuine opportunity for consultations among relevant stakeholders when developing education and guidance is also important. It's really an opportunity for the regulator to listen to others' viewpoints, integrate perspectives, and ensure that any guidance that it eventually puts out is relevant and workable in practice. And I think there again, the regulator can play an important role in supporting and promoting good actors and the contribution of good actors. Providing a safe place for organizations in turn to be able to consult the regulator and seek advice prior to rolling out significant high-risk initiatives or programs, I'd say is also a key role of an effective modern regulator, you know, whether that be in the form of advisory opinions or regulatory sandboxes. This is an important way of supporting responsible innovation, but also in a safe environment first to test things out before full deployment. Of course, there are lots of considerations that, you know, you'd have to think through a model like this, including resources. Can be extremely resource intensive, so you'd have to think about how you would fund this. You'd have to think about selection criteria for deciding who gets the regulator's ear from a fair competition perspective. You'd have to think about how you protect the confidentiality of business information, but yet also be transparent and share the benefits of the consultations with all Ontarian certainly all Ontarian, you know, taxpayers who support and fund the regulator, how to wall off this process from the tribunal so that you preserve your impartiality should you as a regulator later receive complaints about, you know, the very innovation you had a hand in advising on. So lots to think about and work through, but certainly I think it's doable, and we've seen some really innovation models in other jurisdictions start to emerge. And finally, I'd say by participating in the development of industry codes of practice and even endorsing them when and if appropriate would also be a very effective way for a regulator to support responsible innovation and the responsible actors trying to do essentially the right thing.
So I encourage call attendees to read through the IPC submission if you haven't done so already. It very helpfully articulates a legislative framework, among other things. It articulates a legislative framework for different authorities for processing of personal information. And interestingly, at least I found it interesting, the IPC submission recommends that an Ontario law maintain the structure of consent being the principal gateway for permissible processing, and that an organization should be required first to consider when they can obtain consent for processing before relying on an exception to consent. And again, it's we don't have the time, but it's very helpful to read through the various types of exceptions to consent that are articulated in the submission. But Commissioner, can you elaborate on this point about the principal gateway for processing being consent, including how you can reconcile this approach with the acknowledged increasing challenges for obtaining consent for highly complex data processing activities?
Sure. You know, the GDPR approach of enabling alternative grounds for processing all on an equal footing is certainly an interesting one, and one that may be appropriate in a public sector context where governments derive, you know, democratic legitimacy to act on behalf of and in the interests of its citizens. But I think it may be ill-suited for the private sector context, at least in Canada, given the significant legal emphasis we place on individual autonomy, and given our tradition as a society that's grown up on the concept of consent. The idea of providing alternative grounds for lawful processing all on equal footing, with one not any more important than the other, if anything, at least in my humble view, may inadvertently create a disincentive for organizations to choose consent. In fact, many EU regulators are very clear in telling organizations to choose well, because once they've selected consent, for example, they can't then swap to another lawful basis if consent doesn't work for them or if obtaining consent proves to be difficult. So in other words, there doesn't seem to be much incentive for organizations to even try consent. And my own view is that we should at least give consent a chance, you know, give consumers the opportunity to make meaningful choices for themselves before we write them out of a decision-making process altogether. But of course, the necessary precondition for this is that the law has to be very clear on what constitutes valid, meaningful consent. So there's no more cutting corners with dense 30-page privacy policies of legalese that we all know people don't read and wouldn't even understand if they tried. So only where consent is not practicable or even possible, and an organization is prepared to demonstrate why that's so if called upon, then we need to provide alternative governance frameworks, processes, and decision-making criteria for permitting, you know, use of personal information without consent where justifiable. And any new exceptions to consent, you know, how they're framed, their conditions, their parameters, will be, as I said in the submission, I think the most challenging and critical thing to get right in any new private sector privacy law. And to be clear, it wouldn't be enough in my view to say this is a highly complex application of AI, no one's going to understand it, and therefore we qualify for an exception to consent. I think there's got to be a lot of thought given to examining the purpose, the fairness and legitimacy of such processing, and carefully examining and weighing the benefits and risks, and certainly to whom, from the perspective of different stakeholders.
There's par for the course. There's so much to unpack in those comments, and so insightful. And we're going to need to focus on those on future, not just on future calls, but most importantly, as stakeholders in the privacy arena, as we consider statutory reform across the country. Some of the concepts that you've laid out there, in my view, just require very healthy discourse to strike the balance and embed some of the core values of what you just articulated. The IPC submission does a great job at helping to lay out the framework for those type of future discussions. It focuses on potential exceptions to consent for use by organizations. And it also talks and speaks to about exceptions to consent, or what might be referred to as mechanisms to facilitate lawful sharing of personal information. one of the concepts that is elaborated in the paper, and this is a discussion, a concept that's been raised in other fora as well, is the idea of and I put in quotes, a data trust. So Commissioner Kosem, how can a data trust be utilized as a mechanism to enable, to facilitate very important data sharing initiatives, including in situations where, as you just mentioned, consent is not practicable, appropriate, or reasonable in the circumstances?
Sure. So data trusts are certainly a very interesting idea that's been emerging and could be a possible means, among others, of implementing substitute consent models where decisions are made by a trusted third party or fiduciary in the interests of consumers and on their behalf, particularly in cases where consent's not practicable or even possible. Now, I've been at workshops with incredibly smart experts and lawyers who have had to do legal gymnastics and conniptions to try and apply the formal concept of a legal trust to the data context. And my own conclusion is trying to force that application of a formal trust in the strict legal sense may be a bit of a red herring. On the other hand, there are many other less formal, flexible forms of so-called data trust that could be quite apt and important to consider as a legitimate mechanism of substitute decision-making when consent is not practicable or even possible. And I'm thinking here, for example, of designated prescribed entities under Ontario's PHIPAA as one such form of a data trust that's charged with receiving third-party access requests and allowing access to Ontarians' health data for specific beneficial purposes and under specific conditions in the interests of all Ontarians. But just like prescribed entities, any such trust, would have to be carefully designed to derive the legitimacy that it needs to make such important decisions on behalf of others. And it requires a lot of careful thought as to its status, its independence, its composition, its authorities, its accountabilities, decision-making criteria, the alignment of interests with the greater good and the appropriate oversight by the regulator. For instance, to go back to prescribed entities as an example, they have to, every 3 years, be reviewed by my office to ensure that their privacy policies and practices continue to be in compliance with the Act and protecting, the privacy and confidentiality of the personal health information they hold in trust. Now, having just completed this most recent round of three-year reviews, I can certainly personally attest to how thorough these reviews are and how critically important this form of in-depth regulatory oversight is and how warranted it is, particularly when you think about the level of risks involved. So certainly data trusts are important mechanism among others to consider, and I would certainly encourage and I would welcome to be part of further discussions on that front.
So, Commissioner, we've run out of time for this call, but I just want to thank you again for joining us and providing your incredibly helpful insights. They set out a practical approach to dealing with very nuanced and complex issues, and they also serve to highlight that while sometimes they appear simple and straightforward, a concept like consent or an exception to consent or a concept of a data trust, to draft these in a way that's actually going to stand the test of time, that's going to serve as an effective guardrail for the knowledge economy, that we're going to be able to ensure that we could rely upon to facilitate important data flows in a way that practically addresses privacy concerns. It takes a lot of time and a lot of thought and a lot of discussion. So thank you so much for those comments and again for joining us. And for call attendees, I encourage you again to take advantage of our expanded access privacy platform, including our new health sectoral hub. Commissioner Kosem mentioned this concept of data integration units, and we've just completed a very lengthy snapshot topic hub on data integration hub. We're going to be posting that. It's incredibly interesting, but also a really helpful concept that's being integrated here in the province, but important, I think, for the very discussions that we've been having in this call and in previous calls and across the country as we deal with legislative reform. And most importantly, thank you again for joining us on our call. We hope you found it helpful, and I look forward to speaking with you on our next monthly call in November. Thank you.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.